Last week, we considered God's intention of using every one of his children to accomplish his purposes. This grew out of this effort on our church's part to really grow in greater spiritual health with the intention of being healthy in order that we might have that much more capacity to care for God's people. And so again, last week we considered how it is that God has given to each believer, each one, a measure of faith. He's assigned to each one a measure of faith to exercise the gifts that he supplies for the purpose of advancing his kingdom. And we looked at Romans chapter 12. And you might recall that we began that look by acknowledging first the story of what's often described as the sinful woman from Luke chapter 7. And she's the one who came and worshipped at Jesus' feet. And we noted her unabashed adoration of Jesus. And it was stunning then, and it's stunning now when we read the account. And the reason why she was so possessed with gratitude is that she had been forgiven much. She therefore loved much, Jesus says. Well, that's the same starting point for the Apostle Paul when he exhorts the church in Romans 12 to fulfill the calling that each member has to serve the Lord. He says, by the mercies of God, present your bodies as living sacrifices. So as we consider what God has done for us, as the gospel explains to us the great gift of love that he has given to us, how will we respond? Well, we were encouraged to respond like the woman at the feet of Jesus. Whole life, whole heart, unabashed adoration and service to our Lord. Well, the context that the apostle immediately speaks of is the place in which we are to exercise that reasonable response, that reasonable service. It's the church. And to that end, each has been given a measure of faith to exercise the gifts that God has assigned. And as such, we are not to think of ourselves more highly than we ought to think. Each member of the church is needed, just as it is in a human body, so it is in the church. Each member, each part is needed to be healthy. And then we noted how Paul uses imperative after imperative, command after command, to direct his readers to exercise the gifts each has been assigned in order that the body would be healthy and fulfill its task, right? If prophecy, in proportion to our faith. If serving, in our serving. One who teaches, in his teaching. One who exhorts, in his exhortation. The one who contributes in generosity. The one who leads with zeal. The one who does acts of mercy with cheerfulness. And again, despite those coming to us in the form of a command and the imperative, we are not to serve God grudgingly. It's not just that we're obeying those commands. Rather, it's by the mercies of God, present your bodies as living sacrifices. So out of loving gratitude for God, like the woman at Jesus' feet, who washed his feet with her hair in front of many men who scorned her because she was this sinful woman, we are to respond with ready service to the call that God places upon us. Well, given the metaphor of the body that the apostle uses to explain the need for everyone to do their part, it makes sense that he then turns to the ethic that is supposed to govern the functioning of the body. And it shouldn't be surprising that the leading thought is that of love, which one commentator notes is enshrined as the foundational and characteristic ethical norm of Christianity. And while the gifts are distributed variously, right, one to this person, a different one to that person, the command to love is universal. It's for everyone in the church. Paul says it this way, let love be genuine. Abhor what is evil, hold fast to what is good. Love one another with brotherly affection. Outdo one another in showing honor. Now, the literal Greek behind this translation, let love be genuine, is quite sparse. It lacks a verb. It literally says, the love genuine. Now, I'm going to warn you that this is a particular passage that has a lot of Greek that's not very straightforward. So every time I'm saying the Greek says the Greek this, I'm not trying to sort of sound erudite. I'm just trying to get at what the passage says. And you'll note this because if you look at different translations of this passage, they're different. Not in substance, but in word choice. And that's because translation, it's an art, it's not a science. And so as we look at the Greek underneath this, we learn the English translations try to reflect it, and some choose a little nuance this way, some nuance that way. But this opening language, let love be genuine, really just says the love genuine. I mean, one can almost envision a colon after that opening statement. In some respects, that's what he is doing in the language that follows, right? He speaks of a genuine love and then goes on to describe what that love looks like. Now, the one we're reading from, the English Standard Version, the ESV, and virtually every other English translation turns those opening words into an imperative. Let love be genuine. And this is done because the entire intent of Paul is to appeal to or to exhort his readers to live the new life that they've been given in Christ in a way that reflects that new life, not their old. So the verb is supplied that is in accord with that intent. Let love be genuine. But there's even something more to be discovered in this language. The ESV is perfectly fine, captures the intent of the language, but there are a number of translations that render the Greek slightly more literally. For instance, the New American or the New King James. They render it, let love be without hypocrisy. Let love be without hypocrisy. And the word hypocrisy is essentially a transliteration of the Greek word with a negation in front of it. That is, without hypocrisy or not hypocrisy. What does it mean to love without hypocrisy? Or what does it mean to be hypocritical in love? Well, it's illustrative to learn that the Greek word comes from the Greek theater. It means to play a part, to be an actor, to pretend. So the definition of hypocrisy in English is the practice of claiming to have moral standards or beliefs to which one's own behavior does not conform. It's pretense. That's playing a part, acting like you are a moral person when in fact you don't. You do the very thing that you are condemning. And this is what Paul calls the Pharisees. Jesus calls the Pharisees at one point, right? Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you are like whitewashed tombs, which outwardly appear beautiful, but within they are full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness, so that you also outwardly appear righteous to men, but within you are full of hypocrisy and iniquity. This tendency is a problem for religious folk. Because virtually all religion expects certain behavior. And the behavior becomes feigned. The rituals are just gone through. The smiles are exchanged. The alms are given. But the heart is not engaged. The actions are not done out of love for God or for neighbor. Hence that language in Isaiah chapter 1. Your new moons, your appointed feasts, my soul hates, God says. They become a burden to me. I'm weary of bearing them. And yet these are appointed feasts. These are ones that God said by his law they are to do. But he's become weary of them. When you spread out your hands, I'll hide my eyes from you. Even though you make many prayers, I'll not listen. Your hands are full of blood. Wash yourselves, make yourselves clean, remove the evil of your deeds from before my eyes, cease to do evil, learn to do good, seek justice, correct oppression, bring justice to the fatherless, plead the widow's cause. See, it's easy to look righteous, to sound righteous, to be like the Pharisees Jesus upbraided, whitewashed tombs, outwardly beautiful but full of dead men's bones. That's a problem that religious people have. And so the apostle understands this. This is what Paul understands. This is why he exhorts Christians to love without hypocrisy. He's asking that they not play the part of one who loves, but that they love sincerely, genuinely. If love is, as that commentator said, enshrined as the foundational and characteristic ethical norm of Christianity, then it's absolutely critical that we understand how this is to be present in our lives, in our church, and among our neighbors. It is vitally important. Now, why would love have such a prominent place? Well, Jesus said it is to be the prominent and public feature of his followers. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another just as I have loved you. You also are to love one another. By this, all people will know that you are my disciples if you have love one for another. You see, love is this prominent ethic, this dominant characteristic, because the church is a product of love. Right? The famous language in John chapter 3, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son that whoever believed in him would not perish but have everlasting life. Paul writes in Romans, God shows his love for us and that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. The church is a product of love. And so, therefore, love must be present. Love is to be the defining characteristics of the followers of Jesus because it is love that made them followers of Jesus. And for it to be that which marks out his disciples, then it must be genuine, without hypocrisy. For Jesus' love was without hypocrisy. Right? When he laid down his life for his friends, he wasn't playing a part. He was doing the Father's will out of genuine love for his Father and unfeigned love for his sheep. I suggested before that the opening language, let love be genuine, could serve as a heading, with the language that follows being an explanation of what is meant by genuine or unhypocritical love. And Paul goes on, he says this, let love be genuine, abhor what is evil, hold fast to what is good, love one another with brotherly affection, outdo one another in showing honor. This notion that this let love be genuine kind of stands at the head of this, and that which follows as an explanation is strengthened, again, by the underlying Greek being participles. That's their ing words. So you could translate it this way, let love be genuine, abhorring what is evil, holding fast to what is good, loving one another with brotherly affection, outdoing one another and showing honor. Virtually all translations, however, have the language as imperatives. And this is because the Greek, apparently influenced by Semitic uses, allows for participles to function as imperatives, as commands. So the translation we have, it's fine. But most scholars understand the following imperatives as being descriptive of what it means to love without hypocrisy. And what's the first on the list? It's abhor what is evil, hold fast to what is good. Abhor what is evil, hold fast to what is good. This first part has this two-part exhortation. Abhor what is evil, hold fast to what is good. Abhor is a strong word. And it's the only time it's used in the New Testament. It means to have a horror of. And some translations even say hate. So it's striking, right? In its contrast, we just preceded. First we're told to love, and now we're being told to hate. How could this be? Well, biblically speaking, love has a standard. Right? Love does not mean anything goes. The Bible understands that there is evil in the world and that there is good in the world. And genuine love holds fast to the good and abhors, it hates the evil. And this is the nature of God. The Bible declares that God loves. In fact, it goes so far as to say that he is love. But it also said that God hates. Consider this following language from Proverbs 6. There are six things that the Lord hates. Seven are an abomination to him. Haughty eyes, a lying tongue, and hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that make haste to run to evil, a false witness who breathes out lies, and one who sows discord among brothers. These things are evil, and they are the opposite of love. Each of those evils express anything but love, as they all seek to do harm to the other. And what they do is express the darkness of the human heart, a heart corrupted by sin. Yet, it's just in this reality, hearts corrupted by sin, that we discover that God is love. Because he sent his Son to deal with sin. When we say God is love, it doesn't mean that he loves everyone just the way they are. I mean, if that were the case, he wouldn't have sent his Son to bear the wrath poured out on account of sin. He doesn't like everybody just the way they are. People speak of God's unconditional love, but that's not really accurate. At the very least, it is misleading. For us to have access to God's love, there was a huge condition that had to be met. An insurmountable condition to be met on our part. And it was met by God himself in the giving of his Son. Listen to what Paul says in Romans 8. God has done what the law, weakened by the flesh, could not do. By sending his own son in the likeness of sinful flesh and for sin, he condemned sin in the flesh in order that the righteous requirement of the law might be fulfilled in us who walk not according to the flesh, but according to the Spirit. See, we were hopeless. Right? Sin was before us, explained to us, put before us in the law of God, and we were weakened through sin to accomplish it. So what does God do? He sends his son to accomplish the righteousness of the law. That's a huge condition that had to be met, that we might have eternal life. If we had any hope of fulfilling that law, it required that God would send his son to accomplish righteousness on our behalf, so followed up by the outpouring of his Spirit so that we might be regenerated and begin to be transformed more and more to the image of the one who walked in perfect obedience before his Father. See, God's love is not unconditional. It is conditioned upon obedience, and it was his only begotten Son who was perfectly obedient. All this to say that sin is sin, evil is evil, and the dying of Jesus on the cross doesn't change any of that. What it does is provide a means by which sinful, evil people like you and me might not have to suffer the consequences for sin. God still hates sin, and we are to hate sin. And hence the apostle says, abhor what is evil. But how does our hating evil and holding fast to good meet the need for our love to be genuine? In fact, that holding fast, the root of it really means glue. To be glued to what is good. Well, it means that in our relationships with one another, we will not be lackadaisical about the sin in our lives or in the lives of others. There's no play acting allowed among Christians. We will encourage one another, press on in our sanctification, yet we'll do so with humility towards one another. Paul writes in Galatians, brothers, if anyone is caught in any transgression, you who are spiritual should restore him in a spirit of gentleness. Keep watching yourself, lest you too be tempted. To hold fast to what is good and to abhor what is evil means that we will work together to persevere in the will of God, which is good. Right? This famous language from Romans 8:28. And we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to his purpose. And it means holding on to that standard of love. As Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 13, love does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices in the truth. See, to participate in evil and to encourage others to do so is not love. Love that is genuine has a voice. It speaks up in the face of evil and declares the good. And so when the Christian speaks up and challenges, for instance, fashionable ideas that run contrary to biblical ethics, it might be called hate speech, but it's actually an act of love. It's not just a difference of opinion or taste. It's a matter of eternal judgment. But here the Christian must be sure that when he or she speaks up, that love is the motivation. For it is not difficult to slip into that self-righteousness or self-preservation. And we were told to abhor what is evil. It is not a license to abuse. It is a call to maintain the standard by which love is truly marked so that those who are bound up by the evil might hear the truth. And they won't hear it if the one proclaiming is a hypocrite who plays at righteousness, who mouths biblical precepts to others but does not hear them himself. Genuine love abhors what is evil and holds fast to what is good. Paul then goes on to allude to the church as a family. He says, love one another with brotherly affection. And here, the two words, this love one another with brotherly affection, there's two words in this short phrase that have the same stem. For love. It's the one that gave us the name of a city, Philadelphia, right? The city of brotherly love. But the other is used to indicate familial love, solicitous love. The New King James translates it, be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love. A solicitous love is characterized by or showing interest or concern in the other, something that you would associate with parents for their children. It's an active love that takes the concerns of the other as though they were their own. An expectation to love that has a sense of this inescapable nature of the relationship. There's something very unsettling about a lack of love between family members. It strikes a dissonant chord. There's a brother and sister in our building complex where our family lives, and they live 5 doors away from each other, and the brother has absolutely nothing to do with the sister. He hasn't spoken to her in years. He has nothing to do with her husband, with her child. She's even appealed at one point when she saw that I was friendly with him and friendly with her. Would I go and somehow make inroads with him? So there they are in our complex, neighbors, blood relatives, yet they're strangers. And it seems much more grievous than a falling out between two unrelated neighbors. Why? Because there's something inherent in the nature of family relationships that has a certain expectation of a kind of love, this solicitous, caring love. So genuine love, love that is without hypocrisy, will take an active concern. It will concern itself in the affairs of their brother or sister in the family of God. The Apostle John writes in 1 John chapter 3, "By this we know love, that he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers. But if anyone has the world's good and sees his brother in need, yet closes his heart against him, how does the love of God abide in him? Little children, let us not love in word or talk, but in deed and in truth." That is the kind of love that Paul is encouraging here in verse 10. Love one another with brotherly affection. Be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love. But there's one more step to this. This idea of what we might call public recognition. He says, outdo one another in showing honor. Outdo one another in showing honor. See, genuine love, love that is without hypocrisy, truly appreciates the character, the accomplishments, the deeds of the other, and is not unwilling to say so. It sees what God has been doing in that other one's life, and it expresses appreciation. They see the hard work that someone has put in. They see the talents endowed that God has endowed them with, and they appreciate them. And not only that, but they actually go out of their way to praise them. Now, why must he exhort his readers to do this? Well, Paul knows that the very root of humanity's problem is pride. From the very beginning, human beings were reluctant to give God his due. They put themselves forward as deserving as much respect and honor, if not more. After all, right, they bought the lie that God was protecting his own power and privilege when he would not let them eat the forbidden fruit. And this pride is a persistent problem. The fallen nature is intractably narcissistic and self-centered. Even our attempts at honoring others too often has "what's in it for me" dynamic to it. I've asked couples in premarital counseling sessions, "What do you hope to get out of marriage?" "Oh, someone who'll love me, to share my life with me." That's usually the woman. For the man, well, you know, it's either food and sex. That's what it's about. But this is somewhat of a trick question on my part, because the answer I'm looking for is not what I can get out of it, but what I can give into it. To put the other before me, to serve the other, to praise and honor the other. See, this is the heart that is free to give honor where honor is due. And we're reminded that we are to have a love that is genuine, without hypocrisy. So I'm not talking about vain flattery. This is not Mr. Collins from Pride and Prejudice. You're familiar with that character. It's an obsequious, horrible man who's always sucking up to Lady of the Boog, whatever her name was. Now, true honor given to whom honor is due. And Paul says to outdo one another in showing this honor. And it's a part of genuine love because we all have need of encouragement. And acknowledging the honorable deeds or characteristics of another goes a long way toward meeting that end. And in the church is the place where we should find that kind of appreciation for what God is doing in our lives. We shouldn't expect our pagan neighbor to see the same growth in holiness and righteousness, the same growth and appreciation for what God has done, this self-giving, this love that begins to pour out towards God and towards neighbor. You know, we shouldn't expect to say, "Oh, wow, I really admire you." I mean, some might, but the reality is within the life of the church is where we can appreciate what's going on, and we need to give honor where honor is due. So, Paul says to let love be without hypocrisy. And if it's without hypocrisy, it abhors evil, it holds fast to what is good, it's marked by solicitous concern for the other, and seeks that the other is honored and respected as is appropriate, even before oneself is honored. That kind of love, evident, present within a church, is the perfect environment for the use of God's gifts. The Corinthian church, there was a great deal of excitement about the gifts that God had dispensed. I mean, a lot of stuff appears to have been going on. But the environment was not a healthy one. There were factions in the church. There was a presumption of superiority on the part of some, particularly those who appeared to be more well-off than others. There was a lax attitude towards sin, with a sexual sin that Paul says was of a kind that not even was tolerated among the pagans. And church members were dragging one another into court, suing one another, all kinds of things. But man, they had gifts. They had gifts. And not unlike what Paul does in Romans chapter 12, sandwiched in between this discussion about gifts and how God intends to use them, is this discussion of love. And we have this famous chapter. Paul says, "I'll show you a still more excellent way. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I'm a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. If I give away all I have, and if I deliver up my body to be burned, but have not love, I gain nothing. Love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. As for prophecies, they will pass away. As for tongues, they will cease. As for knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part, we prophesy in part, but when the perfect comes, the partial will pass away. When I was a child, I spoke like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. But when I became a man, I gave up childish ways. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I have been fully known. So now faith, hope, and love abide, these three. But the greatest of these is love." Now this passage gets read a lot at weddings. But it's written to a church. I mean, it is good to read at weddings. Because the idea of two becoming one flesh is just as absurd as a whole group of people getting along together and loving one another. And so the call is to indeed exercise the kind of love that Paul has been encouraging, this genuine love, love that is without hypocrisy. And it's that center section that means so much when people hear it at a wedding or at any time. Love is patient, kind, does not envy or boast, not arrogant or rude, does not insist on its own way, not irritable or resentful, does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Why? Because that's how you want to be loved. That's how you want to be loved. And to think that you could link yourself to someone else and that indeed that kind of love would be exercised one for the other is a really extraordinary thing to contemplate. But you see, this was written to a church. So even without the blessing of marriage, there is a possibility to experience this kind of love among people. It doesn't require wedding bands. It doesn't require a covenant between two people that are going to be husband and wife for the rest of their lives. What it requires is a group of people who've yielded themselves in adoration to Jesus, their Savior, and are seeking to serve Him with this unabashed love. So, one of the other characteristics that make up part of a healthy church, as we learned these eight characteristics that we want to see woven into the life of our church in a healthy way, is loving relationships. And the goal for that characteristic is certainly not hypocritical love. It's not just relationships, it's loving relationships. Genuine love, as we've considered it here. And each of these characteristics, gift-based ministry, passionate spirituality, effective structures, inspiring worship service, holistic small groups, need-oriented evangelism, loving relationships, each of these, they all need to be present, and they cannot stand independent of the others. And so it is that we are seeking, as we press on this one particular focus, as we've been encouraged to do, at the same time, we want to be mindful of the kind of healthy environment that will allow that to truly flourish. So that we as a body, as we press towards serving the Lord more closely, more faithfully, more lovingly, and as we see people perhaps stepping out in ministry that will be exciting and inspiring, we give them honor. And we thank God for it. And we encourage them with the kind of brotherly affection that we would encourage a child, saying, "You're doing great. I'm so proud of you." That same kind of love is the kind of love that will allow those gifts to flourish. Well, I pray that God will enable to do just that. That our love here will be genuine, without hypocrisy. That we'll hold that standard up, that indeed we still abhor what is evil, we cling fast to what is good, because that's where the best is for our brothers and sisters. That's where the best is, to cling, hold fast to what is good and to abhor what is evil. And that kind of loving, humble environment will produce a place that indeed we experience one to another the kind of love that Paul envisions.